One quick correction from yesterday. Sister kindly drew to my attention that I said the only, I have trouble with that word, the only reason for study is so that you can help others. Well, of course, that's absurd. That's not the only reason. And I exaggerated, and I must not do that. So please excuse that. I believe you have an outline for this discourse, simply so you can follow where we are and not get lost in all the details. If anyone does not have one, raise your hand and Brother Lauren will pass them out to you. As the way of introduction, I would like to say that as I was growing up in the truth, not that I grew up in the truth, but once I got the truth, as I was growing up in it, there were two things that were a great consternation to me. And that's when something became a difficulty amongst the brethren. I could not much abide those who always talked about the subject. And I could not much abide those who never made their position known. I thought those were two extremes that there was not much room for. And so on this particular topic, I have never spoken on it save in the New Albany Ecclesia. And I don't intend to speak on it in the foreseeable future. But I do feel a responsibility of speaking on it at least once, since in some minds, at least, it is a pressing problem. Although I don't think it should be. We chose this particular day to do it because it was 10 years ago from this platform. I was on a panel with old Brother Murray, Brother Morehouse, Brother Eugene Burns, several. I don't even know what the panel was about anymore, but I remember one thing distinctly. Something came up on this subject, and I made the definite short remark, "Well, I don't believe there are any in there," referring to spirit begotten ones in Babylon. And that's the last remark I ever made on the subject from the platform. And I think on the 10th anniversary of that is a good time to explain the matter a little more deeply. Your outline says mediatorial discourse number 2. Well, it's hard to mediate this kind of a subject because, well, mediatorial discourse number 1 was about the chart. And I can definitely use the chart 2 ways, and I think that's very handy. But this is a subject that you can't use 2 ways. But nevertheless, you can understand both sides of the question, and I think that's imperative. As a matter of fact, that's the whole point of this discourse. I don't think we should ever conclude our minds on a subject until we understand the objections of others. There are very fine Bible students on both sides of this question. And it's absurd to think that they are just simply being ignorant of facts. So don't jump to conclusions. We will attempt to present both sides. I have held both sides of this question. I think I can be singularly objective as a result. For 17 years, I felt there were no spirit-begotten ones in Babylon. For 2 years, I rode the fence, at which time, by the way, I prepared these remarks. So when these remarks were prepared, it was a time when I was studying the subject and really quite undecided in either direction. Since then, I changed my mind, and I am on the other side of the question. And I believe I'm obligated to give reasons why I feel one view is superior to another, but I'm not trying to convince anyone. If for 17 years I held one side, I at least ought to give you the privilege of holding your view for 17 years before you reconsider it. That's only fair. Now we'd go to part number 2 on the outline, a review of the position that there are no spirit-begotten ones in Babylon, a position which I stated I held for 17 years. Number one, perhaps the strongest argument used is based on the parallels. And to put it shortly, the parallels prohibit spirit-begotten ones being in the nominal systems. This parallel, of course, is the parallel of 36 A.D., which is 1881. And the reasoning goes along the line that because God ceased dealing with Babylon at that time totally, just as he ceased dealing with Israel totally at the end of their 70 weeks, no spirit begettal could logically occur. Because of some of the remarks of Brother Russell, I myself was willing somehow to extend that date at least to 1914, although I was really quite unable to explain why. The second point that is usually used in argument that there are no spirit-begotten ones in Babylon is Revelation 18, 21 through 23. A mighty angel took up a stone, like a great millstone, and cast it into the sea, saying, "Thus with violence shall that great city Babylon be thrown down, and shall be found no more at all. And the voice of harpers and musicians and of pipers and trumpeters shall be heard no more at all in thee, and no craftsman shall be found any more in thee, and the light of a candle shall shine no more at all in thee, and the voice of the bridegroom and of the bride shall be heard no more at all in thee." That's the line that is usually used and applied to 1881 and following. The third argument, you will notice that I am only skipping over these very rapidly. I will return to some of these considerations, actually from the other point of view. I'm not trying very hard to argue the way I used to argue on the subject, but I am trying to show you those factors which at the time I used in my mind, plus others. Number three is parables, especially those that are discussed in the third volume. The wheat and tares of Matthew 13, the argument is the wheat is separated, therefore not in Babylon. The parable of the wise and foolish virgins of Matthew 25. And the argument is generally that this applies exclusively to 19th century occurrences, the Miller movement and the final announcement that the bridegroom is present. And therefore, it does not apply since 1874. The fourth item, some legitimate questions that have to be answered. For instance, how much truth is needed to beget? Is it necessary to have more truth to beget in the harvest period than previously? Another legitimate question, what about God's character? Is it right for him to beget someone in unfavorable surroundings where there is no food to feed on? Because I wrote this talk 2 years ago, I have no idea why number five is on your outline. I've totally forgotten what that meant. So we'll skip it. We will go now to Roman numeral number three. Pastoral statements regarding these items that we have just gone over. First of all, what Brother Russell really does say about the parallels. We would first of all like to read a quote from 1912. This is found in the question book, page 155 and 6. Here our pastor writes, quote, "It should be clearly noticed that the parallels between the Jewish and Gospel ages all belong to the nominal systems, then and now. And if this is borne in mind, it will prevent our applying these parallels either to the gathering out of the gospel church, end of quote for a minute, he means the gathering out of the gospel church back in the first advent, resuming quote again, or to the gathering of the Lord's people out of Babylon now, unquote. Well, this is long before 1916. We're not worried about changes of mind or anything like that. This was written in 1912, and Brother Russell is saying the parallels do not apply, quote, to the gathering of the Lord's people out of Babylon now, unquote. He says the parallels have nothing to do with that. These are the things that, as I restudied the subject, began to hit me and make me think that, well, I really wasn't agreeing with the pastor's position on the subject. I was basing it on something the pastor said, but not taking into account everything he said. You will find this same thought in different words in the second volume forward, page 11. That's the 1916 forward. You will find this same thought in different words in reprint 5950 and 51, where even the title makes the point. The harvest is not yet ended. There the title separates the harvest from the parallels. Very clearly. I don't know how, over the years, I read that title and said, well, that title doesn't mean what it says. The title simply says, the harvest isn't over, and this was written after 1914. He was separating the harvest from the parallels, very clearly. All rules of language say that's what that title means. One note on this. This does not negate the 40-year parallel. The 40-year parallel is scriptural, is valid, cannot be thrown away. All it says is, it's not the harvest that's 40 years, it's something else that's 40 years, which is another subject. Now, before we go into Revelation 18, we're finished with the parallels. We would like to make a distinction. Occasionally, there is strife over the meaning of the word fall or destruction of Babylon. Sometimes it is spiritualized. And to be perfectly honest about it, I think that's pure academic dishonesty. If you're reading the pastor's works, it's very clear that he had two things in mind. There is a fall from favor and there is a fall kerplunk when it's gone. And it's really quite dishonest with your own mind if you don't acknowledge the two differences, because you cannot read the pastor's writings logically, unless you see that distinction. There is a fall from favor, but there is also a hard, crushing, actual fall into oblivion. Now let's go back to Revelation 18. We have read 21 through 23. It talks about casting of Babylon into the sea like a millstone. And ultimately, in 23, it says, the voice of the bridegroom and the bride shall be heard no more all in her. Let's examine verse 21 first. Verse 21, Brother Russell applies only, this time I'm not exaggerating, only, and consistently to the future from his day in the volumes and in the reprints. Let me give you several citations. I am explaining in my own words what is in the citations, but if you read them, I think you will see that I am not misrepresenting the pastor. Reprint 694. He says, the great company is delivered from Babylon when this verse is fulfilled. Reprint 275. That's the original draft. He says, pyramid, little t, equals the great company after the bride is exalted and the great company liberated from Babylon at its fall. Reprint 50:58 links this verse 21 with the final anarchy. Reprint 5142 links Revelation 18:21 as the final part of the trouble. Volume 4, page 37, compares Revelation 18:21 with the gradual destruction. And Brother Russell says, this verse, verse 21, is not gradual. It is, quote, sudden, violent, and complete, unquote. His own words. Volume 5, page 369. He says this verse 21 is future when Babylon goes into oblivion. This volume 5, by the way, is part of the study on hell. Strange we should find something on Spirit Begettel in Babylon there. But it's talking about Babylon, and he is talking about oblivion, destruction, just as hell means, absolute dissolution of life, disappearance, covered over, gone. And he applies this verse in his context of a discussion of oblivion as the meaning of Sheol, connecting it with an Old Testament text. Volume 6, page 619, says that this verse 21 is future. Without exception, Brother Russell says Revelation 18:21 is future from his day. Verse 23. And here's the problem. When we read it, you notice that it is a context. There is a flow of idea. A mighty angel took up a stone like a millstone, cast it in the sea, saying, thus with violence shall that great city Babylon be thrown down and be found no more at all, oblivion. And the voice of harpers will not be heard in her, and the light of a candle, and the voice of the bridegroom and the bride shall be heard no more at all in thee. Now, with that context, I was exceptionally surprised, to find out that Brother Russell consistently applied verse 23 to the past. Verse 21, future. Verse 23, past. And yet, it's almost all one sentence. One as the result of another. And I was confused. And I was confused for some time. Except, by the way, he even put a date on that. Verse 23. He said 1881. For verse 23. Very consistently. Until or through reprint 3884, 1906. And then he's silent on it. He doesn't mention it at all for 2 years. In 1908, in the question book, is, as far as I can determine, the pastor's last statement on the subject. In other words, all the way through 1906, he says verse 23 is past, 1881. 1906 is the last time he says it. 2 years silence, and he only says one more thing on it from then on until his ministry ends. And this is question book, page 720. Quote, the time is rapidly approaching when the voice of the bridegroom and the voice of the bride will not be heard there, unquote. There he puts in future. The only time, the last statement, and then he never touches it again all the other years that he's alive that I can find. Now I choose, in my own cogitations, to accept this last statement of Brother Russell's. Not because it's the last. I don't believe in playing date games with Brother Russell's writings. I like to reason on what he said. But I choose this one because it fits the context, not because it's the last statement he made. Since it is all one sentence, it says Babylon will be cast and found no more, and then it tells all the results of that, and one of the results is the voice of the bride and bridegroom are heard no more at all in her. Go on to the parables of volume 3. If you recall, When I mentioned the wheat and tares previously, the argument was the wheat is separated, therefore not in Babylon. My studies determined Brother Russell did not present the matter that way. Reprint 5574, quote, "The ripe wheat of the gospel church are to be separated from the unripe wheat and the tares at the end of this age. They are to be exalted and glorified before the burning and consuming trouble shall come." So his position was not that all the wheat would come out before the burning of the tares came. His position was that only the ripe wheat would come out. On the wise and foolish virgin parable, which, as I previously mentioned, is frequently said to be a 19th century occurrence and not applying in our day. Here is the pastor's remarks on it. Wise and Foolish Virgins, question book 289, quote, "Nearly all the scriptural pictures with reference to the great company would indicate that the special time for their tribulation would be at the close of this age, apparently just after the church will all be gathered. As, for instance, the parable of the wise and foolish virgins." There, he points out the parable extends until the church is totally gathered. Summaries from the volumes. Volume 3, pages 91 through 94. Brother Russell says the parable refers to classes at different times during the harvest, not to individuals who experience the whole thing. So he's saying it is not isolated to a few years in the 19th century. He explains that experience in the great time of trouble will be the market where the great company gets its oil. Now, obviously, the very earliest we could say the great time of trouble is 1914. That puts us into the 20th century with this parable. However, in reprint 5526, he says World War I is not the great time of trouble. That by the great time of trouble, he means the final fire or anarchy stage. So hence, by his own definition, the great company still needs oil, and the parable is not yet fulfilled. On page 92, he says, "All are aroused, but not all are led out." Hence, the unripe wheat is not separated. Volume 3, pages 190 through 194, Brother Russell says, "The presence is the test which separates the wise and foolish virgins." Is that the test in our midst? I don't think so. I don't think that's too much of a problem here. The presence is generally accepted by all the brethren. And he says the foolish don't leave Babylon, hence they don't see the presence. Then on pages 195 and 6, he says, "The foolish knock, but the door is shut because the wise are complete." So the foolish haven't knocked yet unless we acknowledge that the wise are complete. Volume 3, page 206, paragraph 1. He says, "The door in Matthew 25, 1 through 12 is the end of all opportunity to enter the bride." And since that's not closed, the parable is still in effect. Let's go on our outline to some of the legitimate questions that we can ask. For instance, how much truth does it take to beget someone? Brother Russell says in volume 4, page 608, paragraph 2, that human creed beds are long enough for babes in Christ. I think an important distinction must be made here. God begets by His Word. Babylon never begot anyone. And never did. Never will. And does not at the moment. Only God begets by His Word. Now let's take a summary of some of Brother Russell's citations, which show his thinking on how much truth it takes to beget. Reprint 5656. He says, just as very little is needed in the dark ages, likewise now. Reprint 4900. He says, it is not necessary to understand restitution to give it up. In other words, give up your earthly resurrection. These aren't my words, these are his. Reprint 4648. These are the things that made me change my mind. I'm just sharing some of them with you. 4648. Only devotedness to doing the Father's will is needed to constitute acceptable consecration. That's his concept of what it takes. Then on the question of, you have to understand the ransom to be spirit begotten. Here are his words. Quote, we should not think of making that knowledge a test of brotherhood or fellowship. For aught we know, some of the Lord's people today may be as fully in covenant relationship with him without an appreciation of this philosophy as were some of our forefathers, unquote. Note, that's Brother Russell's words, not mine. If I said it, you'd probably throw me off the platform. But he said it. I'm just trying to share his reasonings with you. Volume 4, page 258. Brother Russell is talking about missionaries, and he says they have not been in vain. He reasons on them. He says they have resulted in spirit begettal with developments of the fruit of the Spirit, true Christian character. And then he adds, however, that cannot be credited to the creeds which are attached to the missionaries. So he does make a distinction. It's not the missionaries or the churches which beget, but it is the word of God that they carry with them. Reprint 5550. Brother Russell summarizes spirit begettal, saying it relies on three steps. One, take a stand for righteousness. Two, receive Christ as your Redeemer. And three, make a full consecration to do God's will. That's all. And then he says, further instruction follows. You get the niceties of the truth afterward. Reprint 2851. He says the saints of the past triumphed despite the confusion which surrounded them, because they had the proper spirit. And he says that some today, having the truth, will fail, because they're satisfied with the truth rather than with the effect the truth has on them. Very sobering. Okay, let's go to another question. What about God's character? Is it fair for him to beget somebody in unfavorable circumstances where there's no truth to feed on? Reason on justice. Justice demands that the same conditions apply, a leveling condition applies for the whole church. The three questions we ask at baptism, why do we ask them? Because we supposedly think that's enough to accept someone as a brother in Christ. We don't ask them anything else. Not about the Lord's presence, not about the ransom, not about restitution, not about anything else. Just the three simple questions in harmony with what we read in Reprint 5550. Is it not unjust not to accept someone because of the place they happen to be sitting at the time they make a consecration? God says, I'm sorry, I can't accept you because you're across the street, sitting in a building with a steeple on it. I know you meet all the conditions I laid down, but you're just sitting in the wrong place. You see, justice is violated. It's certainly no problem for God to beget someone in unfavorable circumstances and then say, all right, move. You said you'd do my will. My will is get out of that place. You won't live there. Let's review a little bit. Number one, the parallels do not apply to the selection of the true church. Number two, Revelation 18, in its context and in its latest explanation, says that the voice of the bridegroom will be heard until Babylon is cast into the sea. Number three, the parables of the wheat and tares, wise and foolish virgins, by the pastor's words, are not yet fulfilled. Number four, the questions about what it takes to beget and where God can legally operate are all answered in Brother Russell's writings. One item, if you ever care to study this subject, and by the way, I'm not admonishing anyone to study it. I don't think it's so terribly important that you arrive at a conclusion on this until you're ready for it. But if you decide to study it, you won't find anything in any of the indexes under Spirit Begettled in Babylon. Why not? Because that was never a question in Brother Russell's mind. What do you have to look under? You look under Great Company. That's the only place you will find what Brother Russell said on it. Because to him, Great Company was synonymous, most of the time, with Spirit-begotten brethren who don't come out of Babylon. So that's the only place you're going to find references on the matter in his writings. Now let's go to the important section, because everything we've done up till now is negative, just showing why the reasonings that I used to use when I discussed the matter with people don't work when we look at Brother Russell's treatment of the subject. And as I said before, you see it opposite of me. I'm perfectly happy with it, at least for the next 17 years. I'm not trying to convince anyone. I'm simply trying to share with you the benefits of my own studies after seeing something in a way that I now consider incorrect. Okay, Roman numeral number four, the basis of belief for those who feel that there are spirit-begotten ones in Babylon. First is types. Reprint 2857, Brother Russell suggests that Lot is a type of the Great Company. And we believe that all the references to Lot in the scriptures back up his conclusion. Let's look, for example, at 2 Peter 2. Beginning with verse 6. And turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah into ashes, condemned them with an overthrow, making them an ensample unto those that after should live ungodly, and delivered just Lot. Notice that Lot was justified, representing someone who's in harmony with God. Vexed with the filthy conversation of the wicked. Now, if he's typical of the Great Company, it does show that the Great Company is uncomfortable. Vexed with the filthy conversation of the wicked. For that righteous man dwelling among them, the church is supposed to be separate, having come out. That righteous man dwelling among them in seeing and hearing vexed his righteous soul from day to day with their unlawful deeds. That tells us something about the Great Company in Babylon. Let's compare Genesis 19, to which Peter makes reference. Verses 12 through 16. This is when the angel has come in to deliver Lot. The man said unto Lot, hast thou here any besides, son-in-law, and thy sons, and thy daughters, and whatsoever thou hast in this city, bring them out of this place. Parallel to Revelation 18:4. Come out of her, my people. For we will destroy this place, because the cry of them is waxen great before the face of the Lord, and the Lord hath sent us to destroy it. Her sins are ascended unto heaven, Revelation 6. Did Lot leave? Let's see what he did. Lot went out, not out of Sodom, just went out of his house, and spake unto his sons-in-law, which married his daughters, and said, up, get you out of this place, for the Lord will destroy this city. But he seemed as one that mocked unto his sons-in-law. The word mocked in the Hebrew means talk nonsense. Dad, what's the matter with you? And that kept Lot in. He didn't have the strength of character to leave. When the morning arose, then the angels hastened Lot, saying, Arise, take thy wife and thy two daughters which are here, lest thou be consumed in the iniquity of the city. And so did he leave. And while he lingered, the men laid hold upon his hand and upon the hand of his wife and upon the hand of his two daughters, and the Lord being merciful unto him, and they brought him forth and set him without the city. Lot never came out. Lot was pulled out. Never came out of his own accord. The summary in verse 29, it came to pass when God destroyed the cities of the plain that God remembered Abraham and sent Lot out of the midst of the overthrow, when he overthrew the cities in the which Lot dwelt. Brother Russell's consistent application of the type of Lot is, he is the great company and he never comes out of his own accord. He has to be forced out at the overthrow. The scapegoat as a type, Tabernacle pages 68 through 72. Brother Russell says, their great tribulation is being forced into freedom by Babylon's fall. And he says this does not occur until the church is beyond the veil. And he bases that on the types of Leviticus 16. Benjamin as a type. Reprint 184. Reprint 4436. Reprint 5231. Jacob's second and beloved wife was named Rachel, which means lamb. And she was a type of the gospel church. The whole gospel church, not just the true church. Rachel was promised first to Jacob, but he received her last after Leah. And Leah apparently pictures the Jewish age, showing that God gets the fruitage of the gospel age before he gets the fruitage of the Jewish age before he gets the fruitage of the gospel age, the fruitage that he really wanted. 7 years Jacob worked for each, showing the equality of the two ages, the parallel ages. Rachel has two sons, the two products of the gospel age. One is Joseph, who represents the Christ in type. And the other is Benjamin, who represents the great company. And his name means son of the right hand. At least so his father called him. But that reminds us of Psalm 45:14. The virgins, her companions, great company, followed her in. They are sons of the right hand. Definitely companions. Benjamin, however, is born when Rachel dies. Therefore, his first name, Rachel calls him Benoni, son of my pain. Brother Russell says that this is representative of the great company finally being born, of Lot finally being pulled out in the travail or death throes of the gospel age. Joseph blesses his younger brethren with five times as much as he gives to his other brethren. Genesis 43:34 and 45:22. Why? Because the great company does get a greater blessing than the rest of the world. They have a spiritual inheritance. If you do not believe in spirit begettal in Babylon, it is now your responsibility to reinterpret those types, because Brother Russell only interpreted them one way. Next, the parables, which we really have virtually already covered. We've already treated the wise and foolish, the wheat and the tares. And we've seen that the pastor's discussion of them tend toward spirit begettal and babble and not against it. And we also have thought at times on that most enigmatic of parables, the penny parable. I still don't know what it means, although recently I heard a discussion of it by Brother Shalhoub on tape, which is the first time that all the questions were answered, so I'm seriously considering his view on the matter at the moment. One thing struck me about the penny parable. There are laborers in the vineyard to the end of the day. Now, whenever this 11th hour is, why would you send somebody in at the 11th hour unless there's harvesting yet to do? That's the one thing about that parable that strikes me. Up till the last moment, laborers are sent in. Why? Because fruit must be brought out. It certainly is suggestive of the fact that there is more to be found. Now, let's go to Roman numeral 4, number 3, prophetic text. This is the strongest area in support of the view that there are spirit-begotten ones in Babylon. On all of these, again, the pastor is consistent. His views never vary. Therefore, you will now be faced with the same problem I was faced with, which made me change my mind, that if you believe there is no spirit begettal in Babylon, you must reinterpret all of the following prophecies without Brother Russell's help, because Brother Russell only explained them one way. Number one, Revelation 19, 1 through 7. In volume 4, page 623, he says that this is referring to the great company speaking after its release from Babylon at its destruction. Reprint 5865, a 1916 article. He applies this Revelation 19, 1 through 7 future from that date to the great company awakened and led out of Babylon by its final fire. Prophecy number two, Isaiah chapter 34, verses 5 and 6. For my sword shall be bathed in heaven. Behold, it shall come down upon Edomia and upon the people of my curse to judgment. The sword of the Lord is filled with blood. It is made fat with fatness and with the blood of lambs and goats. So this destructive effort on Babylon here not only affects goats, hares, but lambs, those who are legitimately the Lord's. Volume 4, page 17. Brother Russell applies these lambs as being the great company left in Babylon until its destruction. Prophecy number 3, Jeremiah 8, 20. The harvest is past, the summer is ended, and we are not saved. Volume 4, page 578. Brother Russell applies this to the great company who stay in Babylon until the bitter end, the winter. Prophecy number 4, Habakkuk, chapter 3. Although the fig tree shall not blossom, neither shall fruit be in the vine, the labor of the olive shall fail, and the field shall yield no meat, the flock shall be cut off from the fold, and there shall be no herd in the stalls, yet I will rejoice in the Lord, I will joy in the God of my salvation. Who is I in verse 18? Reprint 5383 says it is the great company in Babylon until the church is beyond the veil. Prophecy number 5, Isaiah 66, 7 and 8. You know that one about Zion travailing with the child and then the children. We won't read it. And too many references on this. But they are all consistent, with possibly one exception, and we'll refer to that in a moment. Just as a typical example, reprint 16:48-9. Brother Russell says, the man-child is those who do come out of her. That is the Joseph class. The children are those born during the death throes. That is the Benjamin class, great company. Those who fail to recognize the harvest and act on it. And the one exception in all the reprint articles on Isaiah 66, 7, and 8 is reprint 55:74. And if you read this reprint article, you would immediately conclude, ah, Brother Russell changed his mind about this prophecy. The only thing you would conclude if you read it. But this is one of those cases that get us all into trouble. We've heard all over the place where occasionally Brother Russell makes an application of something rather than an interpretation in order to make a point. Now, how do I know that's what he's doing here? This particular reprint article is about the covenants. It's in that 1909 year when he was attempting so hard to clarify the covenants for everyone. And in it, he makes great use of Isaiah 66, comparing it to a covenant. And it sounds for all the world like he has really reinterpreted Isaiah 66. Excuse me. I gave you the wrong reprint article. It's 44:54. 55:74, the one I did give you, is where Brother Russell, much later, still goes back to his original view and corroborates that he retained this view and never changed it. So what that's saying is, he is saying this prophecy means exactly what he always said it meant, but that in this one reprint article of 44:54, he was using it as an application to strengthen understanding of the covenants, and not as a prophecy regarding the great company. Very important to realize why Brother Russell writes an article before we decide he's saying something in it that supports our view. There are some general prophetic-based statements regarding the great company in Babylon until its ultimate collapse. We'd like to give you those citations. Question book 290. This is 1907. Brother Russell says, spirit begettled is likely still going on in Babylon. This is definitely past the 1881 date. I mentioned this to someone when I was discussing the matter, and their whole reference was, well, Brother Russell was just too broad in this article. Maybe he was. You know, this whole subject is really a study of Brother Russell almost more than it is of the Scriptures. So if you're going to study Brother Russell, you can't just dismiss him sometimes as being too broad. And just take what he says. If you don't like it, that's okay. I can't force you. No one can force you to take what he says. But don't take part of it and say, well, the rest of it's too broad, because that's dishonesty with your own mind. Reprint 38:84. He says, the great company will get out only at the fulfillment of Revelation 18:21. Millstone cast into the sea. Reprint 53:83. He says the great company stays in Babylon until the church is glorified and until Babylon falls. Tabernacle 72. The great company must be forced out by the fall of Babylon. Etc., 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 etc. Okay. Let's go on to item number 5 on our outline. What this view is not saying. I now accept the fact from prophecies and types, as well as from Brother Russell's general reasoning, that spirit begettal still exists in Babylon. However, I think it's important not to jump to conclusions about brethren who hold this view, myself included. or to brethren who hold the opposite view, myself included when I did. This is not insisting that there are great hordes there. This is not saying that God is still dealing with Babylon. This is not saying that God is still dealing through Babylon. This is not saying that spirit-begotten ones in her can make their calling and election sure. This is not saying that Brother Russell's work was not done correctly or completely. This is not saying the harvest message isn't needed to make your calling and election sure. None of those things is implied if you happen to believe that spirit-begotten ones exist in Babylon. Item number 6. Now that we've gone through all the prophecy, so what? Anytime you spend enough time studying some subject, it should have some practical advantages. I find 2 practical advantages with the view I now hold over the view I previously held. One is an outward advantage. I feel very relaxed talking with others in witnessing experiences. Because if they say, "Well, the Lord answers my prayers," I used to think, "Sure, yeah, I bet." And I'm sure it showed in my face. They say, "Well, I see His providential overruling in my life. Now I believe that's possible. Previously I did not." It eliminates a lot of judging aspects. It makes me very comfortable. I might be talking to a brother in Christ, and I don't feel guilty about that at all. There is an inward advantage. It makes us considerably less exclusive, which is a real danger. Almost every religion has become exclusive to the point where they lose the value of anything they might have held that was correct. Romans 11, 2 through 5. "God hath not cast away His people, which He foreknew. Know ye not what the Scriptures saith of Elijah, how he maketh intercession to God against Israel, saying, Lord, they have killed thy prophets and digged down thine altars, and I am left alone, just me with the Lord, and they seek my life." Do you ever get that kind of complex? "But what saith the answer of God unto him?" How did God feel about that kind of attitude? "I have reserved to myself 7,000 men who have not bowed the knee to the image of Baal." And Paul says, "Even so then, at this present time also, there is a remnant according to the election of grace." That principle certainly can apply at this end of the age. This particular view of spirit begettal in Babylon, yes versus no, will tend to make you a little more humble and tend to make you a little more appreciative for the light that you do have. Finally, a quote by Brother Russell, reprint. Well, it's not finally, excuse me. I have one more page of notes. 4593, quote, "There is a disposition on the part of some, unconsciously, to fellowship only such Christians as are outside of all denominations. Our true position, nevertheless, is that we recognize all loyal to our Redeemer, whether babes or fully grown, whether in Babylon or out of her, whether they follow with us or indirectly speak evil of us." Brother Russell's attitude is worthy of emulation. And finally, as a summary, 1, The quotes and summaries we have given to you are not meant to prove anything to you. They were all sketchy. We gave them only to stimulate study if you care to study the matter. Number two, this is not a subject for insistence on conformity. For 17 years I held one view. Now I hold another. How am I going to judge someone who doesn't see it as I do? Three, objectively, the pastor's position is very clear. Anyone who says there is no spirit-begotten ones in Babylon, if you study the matter, must realize that you hold an accommodated view. You, as I did, by our own reasoning, have extended the pastor's reasoning and changed it based on an elapsed time factor. Number four, would Brother Russell's view be the same if he were here today? Who knows? If not, however, there must be a reinterpretation of at least the three types and five prophecies we have mentioned. In other words, don't claim you have the pastor's view if you believe there are no spirit-begotten ones in Babylon. Plainly speaking, that's dishonest, because that's not the pastor's view. I'm not saying you can't hold it. I held it for a long time. But don't blame it on Brother Russell. Number five, on this whole matter of the Great Company, in or out of Babylon, we would like to close with a very short sentence from reprint 4078, where Brother Russell is talking about the Great Company, and he says, quote, "Differences of opinion respecting it need cause little concern," unquote. And with that, we will close and pray the Lord's blessing upon your consideration and fellowship. And we hope that we haven't stumbled anyone, because that's the last thing we would want to do. And we offer any apologies if we've said anything in an unwise manner. May the Lord have his blessing.
I imagine, friends, that when we go towards lunch, Dave, Brother Dave, that we'll be discussing it in the hallway, in the chow line, at the lunch table, going home in our cars. And what he said is true. Make it your own. And I, for one, Brother Dave, thank you and respect you for your candor, and I appreciate it. Brother Dave will close with a word of thanks and prayer, a prayer of thanks and praise, and also, Brother Dave, to give thanks for our noonday meal also. I'm sorry. That's the testimony meeting. Okay. That's an hour off. But it was a good thought anyway. We're going to have a 15-minute intermission. Come right back, because then we're going to have a testimony meeting. Brother Dave?
Holy Father, dismiss us with thy blessing. Overrule anything said or done incorrectly or in an improper spirit. Direct us past Jordan to our home. We pray for thy kingdom, for continued fellowship with thee. In Jesus' name, amen.